Hello, I'm Christopher Cassan, and this is Ireland's Edge. On today's episode, will the machines take over the world? From deepfakes to robots, writing to music, artificial intelligence is already transforming our lives at a speed few of us anticipated. While some optimistically believe AI will help us optimize our messy and chaotic world, others caution that we may be creating something we cannot control. At Ireland's Edge in Dingle, I was joined by a panel of fascinating guests to discuss the challenges and opportunities of this brave new world. Mark Little has been at the forefront of technological change for the last two decades, first founding Storyful, then working in senior management at Twitter, before founding his current project, Kinzen, which uses AI to screen dangerous misinformation online, and was recently acquired by Spotify. Mark O'Connell won the Wellcome Prize for his first book, How to Be a Machine, while his subsequent books, Notes from an Apocalypse and A Thread of Violence, have also received widespread critical acclaim. We had also hoped to be joined by Dr. Kerry McInerney from the Laverhulme Centre for the Future of Intelligence in Cambridge, but unfortunately she wasn't able to make it to Dingle due to illness. Do check out Kerry's podcast series, The Good Robot, which explores feminism and technology. I began by asking Mark O'Connell to reflect on some prescient words he wrote 6 years ago.
I wonder if I could start by asking you something that I was thinking about when rereading your book, To Be a Machine, recently, which book came out in 2017, and you actually came here to Ireland's Edge to talk to us about it in 2020. And the book was about transhumanism, about people augmenting themselves in ways that could make them live longer or be more complete humans physically as machines and so on. But you have a chapter in there about AI as well. And of course, in 6 years ago, 2017, I didn't really know anything about artificial intelligence. That was probably true of many people. And in that chapter, you talk about how when you were in Silicon Valley meeting a lot of the people who were telling you that AI was going to change the world, revolutionize the world, maybe even end the world, you were wondering to yourself, is this all sort of a lot of self-aggrandizing nonsense by a bunch of sort of tech entrepreneurs who want to be the masters of the universe and that really, you know, it's not actually that interesting? And you also wondered, or are we the deluded ones because we just don't understand this and actually it is really powerful and really scary? 6 years on from that, in a time where now a lot of us have AI, you know, on our phones in this room, how do you feel about that now?
Yeah, I guess I'm... maybe, if anything, a little bit more skeptical of my own skepticism. So that's kind of the position I adopt in the book, is, you know, open-minded, but basically skeptical about these things. And I do, you know, at the time, I certainly felt in a way that the kind of more grandly apocalyptic or grandly utopian claims about AI were taking up a lot of the oxygen in the room. And they still do, you know. And I did wonder whether, you know, I became kind of quite preoccupied by the ways in which these apocalyptic claims about AI, so like the idea that, you know, AI is going, like a super intelligent AI is going to kind of treat us in the way that we treat the lower primates and sort of use us as a resource or just completely sideline us in terms of the vision for society that it might have. I mean, these are really speculative, almost kind of sci-fi ideas. But I did start to wonder whether these were kind of, these anxieties map on in a quite interesting way to anxieties about unregulated capitalism. So, you know, I wonder whether when we talk about artificial intelligence and when we talk about our fears for what artificial intelligence might become and the kind of societal effects it might have, are we really talking about the kind of worst excesses of capitalism? Is it just a way of kind of conceptualizing those fears? And since then, I've, you know, obviously artificial intelligence has moved on and I've kind of moved away from the subject a little bit, but it has become a real thing. You know, it was always a real thing, of course, but it's become more prevalent and we're seeing it. It's in front of us and we, you know, a lot of us are using it or it is using us. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think AI is going to be an apocalyptic scenario, but I do think in terms of its economic impacts and its societal impacts, it's going to take some reckoning with. So yeah, I think it's a serious set of possibilities and problems.
That's an interesting point you make about like its connection with a kind of unfettered capitalism that we also find maybe a bit scary and incomprehensible at times, and especially because AI is being developed, Mark Little, by many private corporations. This is not something that's sort of primarily at the moment being developed in its most cutting edge way in, you know, universities or state laboratories. It's private companies who are out there doing this research. As somebody who works in the tech industry and has met all sorts of different people, many of whom have those kind of really big, you know, at times messianic or dystopian views of these things, what do you feel that the potential of AI is? You know, when we look at previous technological advances, electricity, the printing press, the wheel, are we at that level of something, or is this actually just sort of the next stage of an internet age that we're already living in?
I suppose every atom of my being is screaming against saying, you know, the tech bros actually could have got something big this time, you know. And I veer between, like yourself, between the cynicism, which I've always had in my career. I was 15 years old. I was told I was prematurely cynical, so I had to be a journalist. I had that. But also, I'm somebody that is nostalgic for the future, to quote a great lyric from the 1980s. I do actually look around the corner and feel empowered by what I see in so many aspects. I think with generative AI and algorithmic AI is a good distinction to make for the moment. We've had AI in existence all around us, like an artificial cloud, for many years. It's in the recommendation systems. If anyone here has been on any social platform in the past week, you have used AI. It's just been done to you. Generative AI, potentially, for the first time, is the conscious coupling of this technology with people's conscious thoughts. And that's why it is particularly significant. And I feel I've kind of graduated from thinking this is kind of like the iPhone to this is like the computer. The electricity analogy, I think, makes an awful lot of sense, because it's impossible to know, as we was the birth of electricity, how this will actually impact and what course it will take. But we do see the associated dangers with the generation of electricity and the power we use and the dirty fuels. So there's a little bit of that as well, I think, speaking to the points you both have made, that what's really significant here, I think, myself personally, is the private control of the public good, which is something that I feel scares the hell out of me. Mm-hmm. So what I've come up with is four rules. First of all, it's essential to hold two contradictory thoughts in your brain at the one time to survive the age of AI. And that is, if you're not scared, you're not paying attention. And if you're not exhilarated by the potential in areas like medicine, then you have no imagination. Second is, don't believe people who can tell you what the outcome is. Do not believe any prophet. The next thing is, don't look at the technology so much as the human behavior that it releases. The phone is not a phone anymore. It's a digital device in your pocket that gives you great power. And then I think finally is, we're not powerless, right? We all collectively and individually, I think, like with climate crisis, I think is a very good analogy here. Each one of us has an ability to put our hand on that scale that balances this toward a positive outcome. And I don't want anyone to think that we're dealing with magic. It's not. Soylent Green, you know, it's humans to think about that analogy.
When you mention electricity there, electricity is an interesting one where a lot of the early development of electricity in a commercial sense was this kind of great race between certain private entrepreneurs, right? People who have become iconic like Tesla and Edison and so on. But it very rapidly became something, because of its power, that was harnessed by states, regulated its power generation and so on. And as you say, often with disastrous results for our climate, although again, hopefully we're eventually going to address that element of electricity generation. But AI is being developed, as we said, by private companies. And when we look at their makeup, their incentives, their behavior in terms of the recent sort of coup and counter coup in OpenAI and the behavior of Microsoft there, should we be scared about the fact that that seems to be going on without the state, without us as citizens being almost in any way involved? Like, is that something where they're being given a bit of free rein and that is creating sort of a lot of risk that we can't predict? Mark?
I think part of this is that we're facing a 21st century technology with 19th century, sometimes 18th century institutions. And so I would like to think that the democratic institutions can stop this and say, right, we're going to legislate for this and we're going to regulate it. But the problem is that so much of this technology undermines the very notion of democracy. And there's a very interesting thing happening. These technologies, including social media, are democratizing the way we live, but they're eroding democracy, that is the public ownership of our destiny. And so we're giving, for example, under the guise of free speech, a megaphone to Elon Musk that he doesn't deserve to have. And I think that's an example where we have seen technology companies where they have set out with great intentions, and the vast majority of people who work in these companies, I know this for experience, are good people with enormous biases. First of all, you know, they dream with their eyes open. Right? They think that because they're good, or they have good intentions for humanity, that everything they do will have good consequences, and we've now seen that is not the case. The second problem is, and this is where Marx's book was so, for me, I've read it twice, once back in when it was published, and more recently, to understand these people who are technology companies or people who look millennia ahead. You know, the effective altruists is one example of this. The accelerationists, they don't care about today's world. They want to colonize Mars. They want to essentially have sentient beings living within an AI. So it's those two things that I find scary. And the final bias, they don't understand the world. They don't understand what it's like to be displaced. They don't understand what it's like to be disadvantaged, to be excluded, to be marginalized, because they're all from Stanford and Yale and Harvard. And from their point of view, the rest of the world really doesn't count. What counts is Sand Hill Road, which bisects Silicon Valley. And that's the scariest part of this.
And something that I know that Dr. Carrie McInerney would be talking about if she had been here today is they also are overwhelmingly white men as well. And so a lot of the models that they are building don't take into account different perspectives and in many ways magnify existing inequalities and discrimination that we have in the world. Because what are we really doing is we're teaching through our world something that's going to think about our world. Mark O'Connell, Mark Little made a point there about the way that these people dream with their eyes open and how there's a kind of a view of the, you know, the unintended consequences to be ignored because this is what we're going to do and it's going to have a good outcome. But artificial intelligence hasn't necessarily developed in the way that people for centuries maybe thought that it would. Like, people have been dreaming of AI since, you know, ancient times, medieval times. The idea was that it would be utterly logical. You know, we could reduce everything, as Leibniz and Hobbes and, you know, people talked about, like, reduce everything to calculation and then there would get cold, hard rationality. But AI isn't like that. AI lies, AI confuses people, it makes jokes, it harasses people.
Gets things wrong,
it gets things wrong, it makes things up. Philosophically, how do we deal with that? Because we're not looking at machines that are just cold, hard, rational. We're looking back at something that behaves in many ways in the ways that we behave, warts and all.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that is, you know, in some ways is quite charming, you know, when you get a ChatGPT generated text and it's full of the same kind of errors and bullshit and, you know, assumptions and biases that a person would have. But yeah, it's, you know, it's concerning as well at the same time. I mean, one of the things that I've come to realize recently is that, you know, you were just talking, Mark, about, you know, these sort of grand, sort of vaunting ambitions about Mars colonization, the future of humanity and so on. And I find it increasingly worrying that really the only people who you hear talk about humanity, capital H humanity and the future of humanity are these people, like the likes of Elon Musk. And they're often quite libertarian, quite right-wing in a lot of cases. I think we've lost that sense of, you know, talking about humanity, talking about the future. We've ceded it to the people who are, you know, building these technologies. And when technologists in general and AI people talk about humanity, they are, as you said, they're talking about a quite specific thing, you know. And when people talk about, well, we need to build an AI that has human interest in mind, that has like human level goals, there are any number of ways of being human, you know. We haven't even agreed amongst ourselves what human interest is. So like being wrong is sort of baked in, do you know what I mean? It is worrying that people are
How do we become comfortable with that? Like, how do we become comfortable with the idea that they make they, whatever pronoun we're going to use, makes mistakes? I mean, because that's like, humans make mistakes, we accept that, right? Yeah. The self-driving car analogy is one that I always think about. You know, we accept large amounts of accidents, deaths on our roads.
Yeah.
We still get in cars every day. We accept that people make mistakes, things happen, and so on. But the idea of cars that would rationally decide the safest outcome overall here is to crash and kill me,
right?
To save
you're in the
four
trolley
people
problem
in that other car.
Yeah.
I'm instinctively not comfortable with that,
right?
Right? So how do we become comfortable living in a world where there are tools that we have created that will either make mistakes or make decisions that we don't like?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Like, I was thinking about this morning, you know, this instinctive terror that we have of, you know, being governed by this, like, hyper-rational kind of almost alien intelligence, this idea of, like, AI kind of controlling our societies. I mean, I think we're a long way off that, and hopefully we never get there. But also, I wonder, like, why do I hope we never get there? Because, you know, a world run by humans is a bit of a bloody mess right now, you know? We're not exactly nailing it, and we never really have.
Let's have a go.
Nailed it. I mean, I don't want to say that, and I don't even think it, but also, you know, like, humans are worse than fallible.
I guess that is, you know, a lot of the kind of existential questions that people have, Mark Little, about what AI might do. If we do achieve the kind of, as you say, like, singularity, like intelligence, where it is thinking for itself rather than just responding to our commands and so on, is that, you know, they might decide for our own good, actually, lads, you messed it up. You know, you destroyed the planet, you can't stop killing each other. The world would be a lot better off if you weren't allowed to do these things. And that is, I suppose, an interesting question, right? Because a lot of the time we want to make the world better, but are we comfortable being told that by a machine?
One of the great things about this moment of time, it challenges the very notion of what we held to be the defining characteristics of our species, right? That we are critical thinkers, we're creative. And this has come along and said, nah, you're like animals. You're basically animals. But that awakes then something else, a kind of a re-enchantment of life where you're in touch with your own emotional intelligence. What is emotional intelligence? Empathy. It's putting yourself in the head of somebody else, not just trying to be sympathetic to them, to be self-aware, to be self-regulated, to have vision. And so for me, when I look deep into the way this is actually starting to be felt in businesses, in lives, in workplaces, I start to see a couple of really interesting and very positive, and maybe this is, I should be a bit more cynical, but the first thing is what we call human-in-the-loop systems. So the job that I do and have done for several years is to use artificial intelligence, putting human journalists, analysts, sitting, going out and looking at vast volumes of content, podcasts, for example, and looking for places where there may be a neo-Nazi using hateful, incitement to hateful violence within that two-hour podcast. And so what we're doing is training the AI to go look for that, because we've shown examples of what that looks like, and then comes back, no, not right, tune it a bit more. There's this golden feedback loop where the intelligence of the human is being augmented. And this is being used in medical diagnostics already, and they predict that there'll be no more radiologists. Stop training radiologists. There's never been a bigger demand for radiologists, because now the demand for the human in the loop is starting to become accelerated. Second major development, which I think shows promise, is the open source development movement when it comes to artificial intelligence. So right now we have foundational models owned after billions of computing power dollars, these big models. But now we start to see smaller models being developed. Potentially could be institutions, it could be public service media, I would love to see, developing their own models to optimize for specific purposes that are in the public domain, that are transparent, that are accountable, and we know how they were trained. We know the content that it was trained on. So this is one of the things I think is super exciting. And then the final thing that I really think is inspiring for me is there's a study of the workplace impact of AI by the Harvard Business School, and they found this what they call a jagged technological frontier, where people assumed AI would do great things with stuff that involved mathematical calculations. This particular form of neural networks used, not good at maths. It's good at making shit up, but not good at maths, right? So the people who tried to put it to good use, like accountants, found out it didn't work. Other people came along and started using it as a co-pilot, where essentially they were sort of sitting in the chair and saying, let's go get this thing, saw exponentially good results. And what they concluded was, if you leave AI as an autopilot and you just fall asleep at the wheel, it will do bad things. If you regard it a bit, not like self-driving cars, but driving a car in which a GPS is sitting there guiding you, I did this morning, detour ahead, you know, warning of the ice in the road, you as a human are still making millions of synapses are firing as you're looking around, you're taking in all the detail around you, you're watching, you're chatting, you're listening to a book, but the GPS and you are in simpatico. But the moment you fall asleep at the wheel,
yeah,
bad things happen. Mm-hmm. So that's more the co-pilot conscious use of AI. If we develop for that future, then I think, again, we have power to shape what happens. The AI doesn't come back and close the...
Because there's a difference, isn't there, between us using the AI and the AI using us, as you mentioned earlier, Mark O'Connell. And I wonder if, as a writer, you feel that in terms of the creativity of AI. Because a lot of the way that AI has come into greater public consciousness really is through ChatGPT, through people being able to give prompts and it gives you back a, yeah, an essay for your college lecturer or, you, yeah, know, your emails at work, prompts, yeah, for presentations, stuff like that, that gave people a way of using it in a way that they hadn't ever thought of, mm, before. But for those of us who make our living through writing, that's a little bit scary because maybe we aren't needed anymore.
Right.
Do, yeah, you worry about that? Do you worry about being replaced by a machine?
It's on the list of worries, yeah. It's, when I flick through my Rolodex, it's definitely, it has a presence, yeah. I haven't reread To Be a Machine in a while, but I think there's a kind of a, not complacency is not the word, but definitely the sort of the prospect of, you know, what I do being replaced by an AI is raised in the book, and I'm sort of a bit jokey about it. And I'm still confident that I think what it is an AI could write a bad novel, or an AI could write a bad work of literary nonfiction, or a kind of a passable, you know, there's been like versions of, Frank Ocean songs have been made and so on. And you can kind of do a passable, like, imitation of a good thing, but you can't make good art, because good art, like, now I'm going to contradict myself shortly, but right now what I'm saying is that
You have two contradictory thoughts, yeah, okay, at one time. Mark told you, okay, it's all right. So.
well, it's part of being human, isn't it? So, you know, something like ChatGPT, it's a large language model, so it's sort of like a really sophisticated autocomplete. So it's predicting what you would do if you were writing a given kind of piece of writing or whatever. And I think what art does is subvert what you should be doing, or kind of subvert cliches. So I'm relatively confident that ChatGPT or any other kind of large language model can do good writing, but not art.
Yeah.
But my confidence is sort of gradually being chipped away because, in keeping with what Mark is saying, AI can be a really useful tool for artists. You know, I think there is this kind of like, oh, keep it away from me. It's like, it's the antithesis of any kind of creativity. It's going to steal our jobs. It's going to, you know, and it can do that, and it will do that, I think. It's a serious problem. But it's also a really potent tool for artists who want to use it in pursuit of, you know, strangeness and the uncanny and, you know, just capabilities that wouldn't ordinarily be there. You know, AI is fundamentally, it's an instrument. It's a tool or a set of tools. And so, you know, it's a cliche to say this of technology, but it is neutral. It's how you use it.
Yeah. If we think of that as AI as an instrument, Mark Little, coming to your experience, like with regards to music, I was fascinated earlier this year to read an article by a guy who had realized that when he was listening to kind of ambient music on Spotify while just like at home producing and editing and stuff, he was hearing a lot of the same stuff over and over and over and over. Mm. And he looked up and found that a lot of AI-generated music was repeating itself all over streaming services in lots of different ways. And he made a very good playlist of 49 versions of exactly the same AI-generated song that was on Spotify in different ways with different names and different artists, fake artist names. And then further found out that a lot of the listeners to those were bots all over the internet. So, you know, is there really music if it's actually a bot listening to an AI generated? Sounds like if a tree falls in it.
I heard a description there for like.
But there are also musicians who have used AI in the production of music. Like, you know, what is your feeling like within the music industry and the music streaming industry?
Yeah.
About the interface of those things, like.
Yeah, no, I'm not in the music side of the business myself in Spotify, but I'm on the safety side. But what I, as a music fan, as someone who's been looking at this for a long time now, what I really think helps to begin with in every creative sphere is to distinguish between the music business and the music ecosystem. Not to say one is more important than the other in terms of for a musician who's gigging and living off their art, The first one, obviously, there are major immediate questions need to be solved. First of all, the provenance of where the content came from that trained the AI, right? So is it right that they should just get access to all this content without, you know, compensating the creator? One question. Second is the moment when an AI starts to create art itself, is there copyright for that art? Is there derivative copyright? And these are fascinating questions. I think provenance, again, the moment the human and the machine did something together, is that's a moment of, I think, great moment of inception. The music ecosystem, we have to look at history and see how technology has created new forms of art. I mean, my uncle was a saxophonist, right? A saxophone started as a joke instrument in orchestras, right? Went on then to become the centerpiece of jazz. We think about the distortion pedal. Was a mistake in a recording studio in the 50s in the United States. And then if you listen to someone, you know, some of the guitarists that have used that to create great art. We think about the moment in 1961 when the boys in the boats, the Cunard sailors, came off with the skiffle and the blues, and they came to Merseyside, and Brian Epstein sold those records, you know, to the Beatles. And so the kind of concept of music being trained, one of the founding members of ABBA talks about listening to the White Album, the entire band, over and over and over and over. They were trained by the Beatles.
Like a language learning model.
Exactly. And so I'm not saying in any way that the scale and the speed of the inception of AI is not going to be disastrous for parts of the business. But we do sometimes ignore things that happen. Like 20 years ago, every top 10 in every European country had English-speaking songs. Today, every top 10 in Europe has got local language songs. My son this week showed me a Spotify Unwrapped, you know, the music he's listened to. He's got stuff from decades, way over decades. When I was a kid, it was whatever was that was going on at the moment, or you were a mod, you were a rocker. But the timelessness of the musical tastes of kids today is really exciting. Yeah. So for me, I think about this idea that if AI is used the right way, we have the right safeguards on the business, it will create an even bigger long tail for a middle class of creators who will be able to use this technology in a way that previously only big record labels would have access to that technology, you know? So now, this entire front row used to be the creative process of one song. That, the musician over there, I'm sorry to point at you directly, madam, but that person will have all the power to make, to market, to license, to publish. And that, I think, is something that, when I'm thinking about the positive outcomes on the music ecosystem, is something I think about a lot.
Which is an amazing thought, the idea of democratizing us all having more tools and being able to do different and, as Mark Connell said, uncanny things. But when the major models, and perhaps the ones that will be the singularities, the ones that are worth, you know, untold trillions, are owned by Google, Microsoft, big companies who rely on selling data, that's much more alarming to me as somebody who, you know, I write a lot of book reviews. That's definitely something I worry about ChatGPT doing, you know. On the bigger scale of the music industry, that's even bigger. On films, the writer's strike on TV and films in the US at the moment, like if it's major multi-trillion dollar global tech corporations who are owning the models, is that something where art is actually just going to become subsumed into these, like,
It's a great point. And I think go back to your point about electricity, right? You know, it started out as a private invention and it became something the mainstay of public infrastructure. So I think that in the positive future, what happens here is that we see companies like Facebook who've open sourced some of their models, like Llama. We see companies like Anthropic, which have a constitution in their AI, starting to realize that this doesn't go anywhere unless we start to solve those immediate democratic deficit problem in AI. There is no future in which this continues as it is today. There's no way. Now, there's ways that they will have proprietary power that's greater than other companies, there's no question. But again, if we think about seeding this new public infrastructure and hoping to God that our politicians and leaders catch up to find this resource, I think a lot about my own background in public service media. Like, I think about the reinvention of that. With all the archive and all the content that RTE has, for example, I mean, it should have its own language model that it owns, and nobody else gets near that content. Now, when that starts to happen, I think we're closer to your electricity analogy. Mm-hmm. Again, this is not mandated. I'm not saying it's going to happen. No predictions, remember. But you see the things we can do to start making sure our leaders take the right decisions. We as voters, we as citizens. And that's where we have the power, just as we have with climate change, just as we have in this case. And if we fail, it'll be our failure. It won't just be because Mark Zuckerberg is a bad man, or, well, I won't even comment on Elon Musk, but, you know, it'll be a collective human failure as well.
But that idea of human failure, I suppose, is at the heart of it all, isn't it, Mark O'Connell? Like the idea, you know, if we thought experiment here that, you know, we actually get close to the point where it's like, maybe we've actually invented something here that is quite dangerous. And there have been a lot of prominent AI figures, you know, many of the most leading AI thinkers who this year have either left or major corporations to say publicly that they're uncomfortable with what's happening, or, you know, trying to raise public awareness of the risks of some of the stuff that's being developed. Can humans be trusted to ever turn back from something that we, like, see? I mean, is the Pandora's box analogy actually just inevitable? Like, do we ever not do something if we can do it?
No, nothing is inevitable, of course. But if you look at history, we've tended to just do what we can, not what we should, right? I mean, that the history of science, in particular the history of technology, is a history of what's possible, and then figure out, you know, deal with the consequences after. So, yeah, I'm not hugely optimistic that we can rein this thing in. I mean, it's, the dichotomy tends to be between, you know, private enterprise and government. And, you know, I don't know which is more unsettling to me, actually. Google owning a super intelligent AI, or the American government, or the Pentagon. I think I probably do know which is more unsettling. And, you know, it'll make me sound like a libertarian, but yeah. I'm not that optimistic that we can really rein it in. Maybe I should be. I don't know. Maybe it's a...
Mark, are you more optimistic?
Capitulation on my part.
Yeah, I mean, I'm way more optimistic that we have the power to do this. What I'm very pessimistic about is the sort of the passivity of the technology. Kind of sits there passively, moves incrementally. Mm. It's out of sight. And that's why with the first wave of algorithmic AI, which was begat social media, which I was involved in when I worked for Twitter, that we had business incentives that were completely out of whack with this sort of like the happy-clappy, we're bringing peace to the world, right? The business incentive was show you an ad to make you feel something, right? So you had to be outraged or excited. And so the algorithm was finding content to shower at you so you'd feel animated and you feel like you want to buy stuff. Mm. Now, when we were talking with people like Jack Dorsey, I mean, this guy came across as Buddha. But like underlying it all, there was a business model that was kind of out of sight. The machine, the algorithm sits on your shoulder. Anytime you go visiting anywhere on the internet, there's a machine on your shoulder, companion. We didn't know about that. Now there's something happening where it's open. And so it's much harder to hide in the shadows, with some exceptions. I worry the hell about facial recognition. Yeah. There's a great book by Kashmir Hill, We Own Your Face, I think it is called. Just finished reading it. And that stuns me, and that's going to be very relevant here in Ireland, where we have now proposals, perhaps because of the riots last Thursday, to bring in facial recognition at protests. And it's where we suddenly, it's not just about some tech bro, you know, deciding I've invented something cool and I'm going to put it out there. You know, for the rest of us in society, we are going to have these choices. And Jeff Bezos, who I don't normally quote, has this imagining. One door, there's a difference in two doors. One door you go in, you can't go back. One door you can go in, you can come back again. And we want to be taking choices that are that second door, that we can try, we can fail, do it quickly, learn, and then move forward. What I worry about sometimes is that we're sort of passively walking into this other door and there's no way back because, you know, we just didn't pay attention. We were asleep at the wheel.
A friend of mine talked to me recently about being in the US on her tour and going to one of these Amazon supermarkets where to get in, it recognizes your face. Then you just walk around and you just pick things off the shelf and it recognizes your face taking them and takes it out of your Amazon account.
Wow.
There's no interaction with people. You can't even get in if it doesn't recognize your face. And like we think about, that's scary enough when it's...
Well, I'll give you one up. My friend was in LA last week and he had an Airbnb and a robot came and delivered his dinner, a kind of a delivery robot, and asked for a tip.
Tip.
And the thing is, I was thinking, he said it to me, he said, I'm just thinking at the end of the world when the AI takes over, right? And I didn't tip the robot. I'm screwed.
The last thing that you saw was the robot. Yeah. Well, I suppose it is one of those things that
the Terminator started, wasn't it?
Skynet, is it?
Yeah, someone didn't tip the robot.
When we think about, you know, a lot of the criticisms of AI, when we say, you know, it can be dangerous, it lies, it can be aggressive, it can be racist, it can be misogynist, it can be, you know... Have you met a human?
Ever look in the mirror?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that we're creating these things in our in our own image. And it's not just, you know, when you talk about, like, are we more scared of Jeff Bezos and Amazon having it or the American government? Both scary. Even more scary, perhaps, the Chinese government having it or the Russian government having it or a totalitarian state having, you know, what can a totalitarian state do with AI that it couldn't have done in a pre-internet age? All of those things are maybe much more scary than when we think about, well, what's going to happen to the Earth in, you know, 1,000 years' time? I suppose we don't necessarily have the luxury of looking that far ahead. We haven't figured this out yet. I wonder if we could finish on that, like, that idea of looking back and looking forward, Mark, because I asked you at the start about how you felt now about your book, you know, 6 years on. And obviously, that's a very difficult thing for any writer, obviously, looking back on something that was written at a particular moment in time. But a lot of those guys, and they were mostly guys, that you interviewed in Silicon Valley for that book, had this idea of making themselves, if not just longer living, almost immortal. And a lot of the language around AI from certain tech figures is a bit about immortality, changing the world, you know, and so on. Is that a positive or a dangerous thing? You know, you mentioned earlier that maybe we've seeded the future too much and that actually we all need to start thinking in a bit more of a long-term visionary way. Or are you still kind of haunted a little bit by those guys?
Well, the way that I think about it now is that, you know, I think so much of the anxiety around AI is an anxiety of replacement of, you know, the analogy of electricity is really striking, I think. But I wonder as well whether it's a kind of an industrial revolution thing where, you know, people working with their hands, physical labor was replaced, and now, you know, the intellectual and artistic labor is in danger of being replaced. But, you know, I think, like, with the transhumanists that I spend time with, the thing that, and they had all sorts of different ideas about what the future would bring and what AI, what sort of utopian sort of developments it might bring, but they were all kind of united by this underlying assumption that people are basically machines. And I think you can only really be, like, Elon Musk is terrified that, at least he claims to be terrified that artificial intelligence is going to replace humans and make us obsolete. And I kind of don't buy into that. I feel like AI or any kind of technology can only make humans obsolete if you think of humans as already being a kind of machine. So, like, I wonder whether all of this is going to, it's going to bring huge disruption, but I wonder whether it will force us to kind of reevaluate, you know, it's a corny expression, but what it means to be human, you know? And humans aren't just computational engines. We're not just there to solve problems, to figure out solutions to things. There's more to being human than something that a machine can replicate.
On that very thought-provoking and vaguely uplifting note, I'm not entirely sure whether I'm inspired or terrified again, but I'd really like to thank Mark O'Connell and Mark Little for speaking to me today. Thank you all very much.
Thank you so much to Mark and Mark for joining me in Diggle. On next week's episode, I speak with three editors of Irish independent news outlets about the future of reporting. To make sure you don't miss that or any of our future episodes, subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Southwind Blows production, and I'm Christopher Cassan. Thank you for joining us. I look forward to your company next time on Ireland's Edge.